So last week we talked about Nehemiah chapter 10 and 11. What do y'all remember from Nehemiah 10 and 11 from last week? I know it's a long time. And Cooper family, I don't expect y'all to know the answer to that one.
But I do.
Yeah, we're working on donuts. So remember, Pastor had talked to us in chapter 9 about the... They talked about in this prayer about how God's faithfulness and the unfaithfulness of the people. God's faithfulness and the unfaithfulness. And then what did they do in chapter 10? Yes, Abby.
They wrote up the list to achieve by separating themselves from the people and focusing on God in their daily life.
And what did they do after they wrote out this stuff? What did they do?
They signed it.
They put their name on it saying, we will be faithful to God. And we're going to be faithful to God in what three areas? In our... In our family home, in our home, we're going to have godly homes, we're going to have godly
work.
Businesses, and what's the last thing?
Worship.
We're going to take care of the temple. We're going to observe the Sabbath, we're going to take care of the temple. So those are the three things they talked about. And then in chapter 11, as we moved into that, then we're going to talk about those unsung heroes that we read about, the whole litany of names that we struggle to read about. But those were the people that faithfully did those things that needed to be done. And in one case, Nehemiah wanted to move people back from outside the area of Jerusalem back into the town of Jerusalem. And he used what method in order to select people? What did he do? Cast the lot, right? One out of every 10 people had to move back in. And it was pretty wise of him doing that because back then, using a lot was akin to saying, this is God's decision. However the lot falls, that was God's decision. So it wasn't like saying, Ran, you're moving back into Jerusalem. Nehemiah didn't have to do that. He just said, Ran, God chose you to move back to Jerusalem. And remember, that was only 1 in 10, but there was a whole group of volunteers that wanted to go back and take on that challenge. And remember, the town had been left desolate for years and years and years. And so, as Steve Olson would say, the infrastructure was not there anymore. And so that's what's going on. Now, we don't know the amount of time that's passed since the wall's been completed to when chapter 11 starts for us, or chapter 12 now, I guess, starts for us, the events of chapter 12. But it does appear that Nehemiah wants to secure the city in terms of the wall's been built, now we're going to secure the city by moving people back in. So that all those things have happened, and now we come to chapter 12. And chapter 12, it reads, now at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, this is going to be a big deal now, they sought out Levites in all their places. Some were living inside the city of Jerusalem. Some were on the outskirts. They were going to get all the Levites from all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgiving and singing, with cymbals and stringed instruments and harps. And the sons of the singers gathered together from the countryside around Jerusalem, from the villages of the Neophathites. Hope I pronounced that right. But it was going to be a planned celebration. And I highlighted the word gladness here. We're going to see the words thanksgiving and gladness repeated throughout this section of Scripture. Praising God for all that they had done. And again, that's just the artist's rendition of what Jerusalem during the time of Nehemiah may have looked like after the wall has been rebuilt for them. The chapter's, well, not quite the end of it. Also that day, they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women, the children also rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off. So that's how this day ends. The people are singing loudly. And again, it's not just a few of them, it's all of them. And I like the way that it puts in here, it's the men and the women, the men, the women, and the children are all participating in this, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off. Usually, we've been to enough football games, and you can stand outside the stadium, and you can tell kind of what's going on with the sound of the crowd, whether the team's winning or losing or whatever's going on. I don't know that the people around this area of Jerusalem could tell exactly the words they were saying or singing or anything like that, but they could understand that there was joy coming from Jerusalem. The Bible only talks about three other times that this kind of noise was created by the people of Judah, the people of Israel, excuse me. The first time was when the Ark of the Covenant showed up right before a battle, and the soldiers shouted with a great joy. The war didn't go very well. but they were happy that the Ark of the Covenant was there. The second time that we talk about this happened almost 100 years earlier when the foundation of the temple was laid, and everybody was excited about the foundation of the temple being laid under Zerubbabel. But remember, that joy was also mixed with some sorrow from people because they remembered what the temple looked like. In this case, that joy permeates the whole crowd. They're all thankful and giving thanks to God for the great things he had done, allowing the wall to be rebuilt and them to come back into the land. The other thing that to me is a little bit significant about this event is that this is a great thing that's happening. And as you look through the rest of the history of Israel, it pretty much spirals down from here in terms of people taking over the land and them not having a place to call their own. Right now they have Jerusalem, right? Well, by the time Jesus is there, right, the Romans have kind of conquested everything. We have Jews that are living there, but it's not theirs. It won't be until 1948 when the UN recognizes Israel as a nation state that they really have a place back in history and everything. So this is, it's a long time between joyous events for the people of Israel. But it, all that said, all this midst of this rubble and all this kind of stuff that's going on, they're thankful to God for all that he had done, which is a great lesson right there. Solomon writes us a couple things in Proverbs. He tells us in 17:22a, a merry heart does good like medicine. He also reminds us in 15:13, a merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, but by sorrow of the heart the spirit is broken. Now then, kind of digressing back, can you imagine what do you think the women, the men, and the children were all singing about as they walked across that wall? As they walked along the wall, what do you think they were singing about? What kind of things would they have praised God about?
His faithfulness.
His faithfulness? What else? So they're back in the land, God's faithfulness, what else? Do what? His mercy? So all those things they had to be thankful for. But the other side is, and I was alluded to this a little earlier, remember their homes hadn't been built. They probably had to scrounge around for materials to build their homes because there wasn't a Home Depot or a Lowe's just around the corner. The city wasn't in the best shape it had been, but all these circumstances didn't keep them from singing and praising God joyfully for all that he had done. Now then, bringing that into kind of today thing and the singing and all that kind of stuff. As a family, we used to go on trips to Dallas and Houston, and this is before the DVDs and all that kind of stuff, Daniel. So the kids had to be somewhat self-entertained. And when they were little, they were in car seats, and that was okay. We could make the four-hour drive. And at that time, it was like 4.5 hours because we were taking bathroom breaks and all that kind of, changing diapers, all that kind of thing. So the normal four-hour trip was sometimes 5 hours kind of thing. And as the kids got bigger, they didn't need car seats, and they'd kind of get the squirms and all this kind of stuff. So in order to entertain, we'd sing on the car trip. And everyone got to pick a song that they'd get to sing. And they'd be songs from church that we had learned and that kind of stuff. And for me, it was a great memory. Now, Molly always got picked on in the car, so that's just the way it went. No, she didn't. But in all this singing and whatever that we're talking about for this, I want to encourage y'all to keep singing. In other words, keep your joyful heart about you. The circumstances for each of us changes from day to day, whether it's work-related or home-related or whatever. I just want to encourage y'all to keep singing like the people of Israel did. They had a lot of stuff they could be bummed out about, but they kept their perspective on things. So again, the points from this chapter, just that joyfulness begins with a clean heart. That's one of the things that Nehemiah made sure that the the servants, the people were purified before they did any of performed any of their rituals or anything like that, their dedication service. And part of that preparation, though, was cleansing their heart, having a pure heart. And then joyfulness is not dependent upon the outward circumstances, but upon our inward focus. And that's what I had for chapter 12. Do you have any questions or anything like that? Yes, honey.
Mm-hmm. But then the gate, is it like a similar ceremony in, for the beginning of the temple, like after it's built and everything, like the priest,
There are two schools of thought with this thing. One, the purification was something akin to like back in Leviticus, if you got mold in the house, there was a purification process for that. And the idea for the gate especially is because the gate had been a place where there had been a lot of death, sacrifices, all kind of carnal sacrifices, the sacrifices to other gods and all that kind of stuff. The idea that these gates had been, if you will, abused, and so they need a ritualistic purification process. And so that was what that was somewhat akin to, that they were talking about this. And in the house, I think it was a sprinkling or something like that, wasn't it, Pastor? I can't remember for sure. But it was like a sprinkling kind of situation. Now, on the other side of it, some of the scholars liken this to like a tool or like a laver or something like that that was used in a ritual, and the purification process for that was a simple washing, again, to make the tool holy. And the idea would be the city would be identified as holy before God. So, thank you very much. Anything else, guys? Now, just to kind of dovetail into this, the beginning of chapter 13 talks about the same day. It says, on that day they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. So it was that they heard the law, they separated from all the mixed multitude of Israel. So the idea is that the purity of marriage, as far as the people of Israel, they were going to uphold that, and they were going to separate themselves from the mixed race, I guess. I don't want to say interracial, because I don't think that was the correct term. But it was marriage to women from or men from other nations and that kind of thing. And so they weren't going to do that. And from our perspective, if I was writing this, this is where Nehemiah would stop. And you could put at the very end of it, and they all lived happily ever after. But that's not what happens. Paul tells us in Romans, he said, for whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. So the next thing we're going to read are going to be some challenges that Nehemiah had to face. And I'm sure he wished he didn't have to face them, because they dealt with disobedience. It wasn't his disobedience, but he still had to deal with that. Yeah. In the case of this, okay, in the next, hold on to that thought, because what's going to happen next is there's going to be a violation of the temple, and the Gentiles were not supposed to be in the temple, okay? It was okay for the Gentiles to convert to Judaism and that kind of thing, but for those that hadn't converted, it was... No. And as we'll see in the next portion of this too, there is business trades that goes on with the Jews in other countries, and that's okay. But then they violate that also, and we're going to read about that as well. Now before this, Elisha, the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of God, was allied with Tobiah. Remember Tobiah, the bad guy? The guy that was opposed to all the work on the wall? And he had prepared for him a large room where previously they had stored grain offerings, the frankincense, the articles, the tithes of grain, the new wine and oil, which were commanded to be given to the Levites and the singers and gatekeepers and the offerings for the priest. But during all this, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Then after certain days, I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. And it grieved me bitterly. Therefore, I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the rooms. Then I commanded them to cleanse the rooms, and I brought back into them the articles of the house of God and the grain offerings and the frankincense. So again, while the cat's away, the mice are going to play. And we already said that Tobiah was one of the enemies of the people of Israel. And in this case, kind of going back to what we had read, this Gentile was not supposed to be in the temple. These rooms, and it was a series of rooms used by the temple for storing things, typically the offerings of the people. So he was in one of these vacated rooms, which also we'll see a problem with that. Why was there a vacated room? But Nehemiah does not call a committee meeting to say, let's sit down and we'll talk about this and maybe we can negotiate our way out of this. No, Nehemiah knew that he had the responsibility and the authority to cleanse, to get rid of this. Now, he didn't himself go in there and pull this stuff out. He had the proper men do that. They cleaned it out. They threw everything out on the road. And this is the last we hear about Tobiah in Nehemiah or anything like that. But he was pretty ticked off. But he confronted the problem, and he aggressively went for what was right. What God had instructed him on doing, what he knew to be right, he took care of it. But unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. Remember those empty rooms? I also realized that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his fields. In other words, they weren't being paid, and they had to eat. So I contended, this word contended also means reprimanded, the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then all Judah brought the tithe of grain and the new wine and the oil to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouses Shilmiah the priest, of Zadok the scribe, and of the Levites, Padiah. And next to him was Hanan, the son of Zakur, the son of Mattiah, for they were considered faithful, and their task was to distribute to their brethren. The thing I'd like to see from the standpoint of Nehemiah is a book about leadership. But in this case, he's an observant leader. He sees that the Levites have been neglected. The Levites are out taking care of themselves rather than having the support of the people. So he's going to find that. He's going to correct that wrong by telling them you did wrong. But he also knows that he's got limitations on himself in terms of he didn't just point out the problem. He's going to find a solution for the problem. And that's one thing that leaders do. They'll see the problem, but they'll also implement solutions for that problem. And in this case, he could have said, well, I'll just watch it myself and make sure everyone does that. But he's smart enough to know that I can't do everything. So he gets these four faithful men to basically administer the offerings coming in to the temple to make sure that things are coming in the way they're supposed to and make sure they're distributed the way they're supposed to, which is very wise on his part. He closes this section by saying, remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its service. In the midst of his anger and frustration with the people, he is still sensitive to God and relies upon God for all these type of matters and brings them before him. The other thing, too, that I think one of the reasons he closes with this, too, and this is just the Mark Schultz version of things coming in here, is that as he looks at this matter, he feels responsible for what's happened now. You can delegate, what is it? You can delegate authority, but you can't delegate responsibility. Is that the way that thing works? So he wants to have a solution that even if I'm not here, if something happens to me, and oh, by the way, we don't hear about Ezra anymore. Last time we heard about Ezra, he's on the wall. And the last there was one other point I wanted to mention too, is that there's going to be a statement in here that talks about the children as they're talking and speaking and not being able to speak Hebrew. They think that somewhere around 7 years has gone past since he had to go back to Jerusalem. There was a 7-year period, and now he's come back. So we'll talk about that in a minute. And Ezra's probably gone at this point. Either he went back to Persia, or he just is no longer among the living. They don't know. But because of these two problems existing within the temple, that's why they think Ezra is not here. And Nehemiah also knows that I'm not going to be here forever either. I may have to go back. I want to make sure that this is a good solution that outlasts me. He feels responsible for this, and so he's going to delegate his authority to take care of this problem. And I think that's part of why he comes in here. Do not wipe out my good deeds that I've done for the house of my God. He feels the onus upon himself for not having thought that through a little bit better and not taking care of the Levites. Because a lot of the things he's doing, he's dependent upon other people to take care of things, and he wants to make sure that they're taken care of properly as well. In those days, I saw the people of Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath. And Ethan, this is that part about the work. And bringing in sheaves and loading donkeys with wines, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Men of Tyre dwelt there also, who brought in fish and all kinds of goods and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What evil thing is this that you do, by which you profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do thus? And did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." So people are bringing in stuff on the Sabbath. Remember, the people had signed the little document saying, "We're going to honor the Sabbath. We promised to do that." And now here it is a few years later, and they're dishonoring the Sabbath. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's a two-headed coin, though, too, because you've got the people of Judah over here, or people of Jerusalem, but you've also got these sellers. So he goes and he warns the sellers, don't do it. But he also knows their deceitfulness. So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath. Now remember, what day is the Sabbath? It's a what day of the week is that, Daniel? The Sabbath. Saturday. But when does the Sabbath actually start then?
Friday.
Who said sundown? Gold star for you, Will. Good job. So from Friday at sundown, we're going to be shutting the gates. And charged that they must not be open until after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens, that would be no loads, okay, would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. Then I warned them and said to them, "Why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay my hands on you, or I will use force against you." That's what he's saying. From that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, and they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath. At this point, he doesn't trust those guys around the gates. He's threatened them, and they've moved back. But he doesn't leave it right there. He talks to the Levites, and he says, "Cleanse yourselves. This is service to God. Cleanse yourselves. Sanctify and protect." Not so much he's concerned about the people buying things as it is protecting the Sabbath. I guess there was a difference. They want to sanctify the Sabbath day, so they're going to make sure that they keep the Sabbath day regardless. He closes by saying, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy." Now again, the quick point here is that this idea of service to God begins with a cleansing of the Levites. And as we look at our service today, do we cleanse ourselves in preparation for service to the Lord? Whether it's teaching, whether it's serving in Awana, whether it's even just cleaning around the church here, are our hearts prepared? Do we prepare ourselves for whatever God may have for us up here or in service to Him, period? And this is finally the last thing. It's probably the most frustrating thing he had to deal with, and that was the domestic disobedience. "Then in those days I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, And half their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one of the other people. This is where the scholars think it was around 5 to 7 years that he was gone, because by the time he left, there was intermarriage that took place, and then there were children that were born, and now the children are old enough to speak, but they can't speak Hebrew. And that's what's so frustrating to him right now, that the children don't understand the language. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there is no king like him, who was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear your doings, all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? One of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, in other words, his grandson, was a son-in-law of Sanballat, or however you pronounce the name, the Horonite. Therefore, I drove him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. So at this point, Nehemiah's met with the people that have intermarried, especially, particularly the Levites who had intermarried. And as we read previously, he cursed them. And the curse that they're talking about is a curse that they had signed for themselves, saying they weren't going to intermarry. He cursed them. He struck some of them. He pulled out their hair, which was a sign of showing disrespect for them as well. And then he made them swear by God that they wouldn't do that again. But it was an ugly situation that he had to take care of. The other thing to be concerned about here is also, especially with Jehoiada, was the fact that the priestly line could not be contaminated with intermarriage. And so that's why he was expelled the way he was. Nehemiah closes by saying, thus I cleansed them of everything pagan. I also assigned duties to the priest and Levites, each to his service, and to bringing the wood offering and the first fruits at the appointed times. Remember me, O my God, for good. And this is how Nehemiah closes out for us. Basically, cleaning house one more time, ensuring that the people in his lifetime were going to live according to God's ways. Now, points to just from this chapter 13, Nehemiah faced this sin head on. We don't see Nehemiah again trying to defuse the situation or talk his way out of it. He meets basically grabs the problem by the throat and strangles it, so to speak. Nehemiah worked toward a permanent correction or solution. And then finally, as we see, Nehemiah led from the knees. And everything, after each of these incidents, he would pray to God about them as well. Now, I do have a question for you guys. As you think about these 13 chapters of Nehemiah that we've gone through, what words come to mind when you think of Nehemiah? And this is just kind of in closing, the conclusion of all things. When you think of Nehemiah, what do you think about? And a prayer?
A lot of time.
Obedient. Obedient, certainly, Rocky. What do you think, Daniel?
Well, he prayed, like Adam said, but he also contemplated a lot. Like,
very good.
The king, he waited 4 months.
Yeah. Yep. He wasn't a shoot from the hip kind of guy, was he? I mean, he took action when he needed to, but he certainly did contemplate, as you said, the implications of everything that he was going to do. Yeah. He knew what he knew.
Yeah.
What you think, Vicar?
Along those lines, he wasn't afraid to call sin sin.
No, he wasn't. The other thing that I appreciate, it would have been easy, especially when you're appointed governor by the Persian king, who is all powerful. That'd be tempting to go to your head to, well, I am, this is my little kingdom right here, and I shall rule it. But he didn't do that. He knew where his limitations were in his role. He was governor, yeah, but when it came to the spiritual matters, Ezra, you do that part. That's your job to do. He didn't try stepping on anybody's toes or directing those activities. I really appreciated that about him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing. He pleads to God a lot. And he always says, my God, remember what I've done, what I tried to do. For someone who's very much appointed by God to do so much, he still humbled himself before God, saying, please remember the good things that I've tried to do.
Anything else, Pastor? Jehoiada?
No, this is Senator.
Okay, sorry. So, him who shall be nameless.
It's just interesting to me that we have this concept of I want what I want, and I should be able to have what I want, do what I want to do, and both are good because I want them. And this guy, no reason to expect that he had anything other than genuine affection for the daughter of Sanballat.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that was wrong for him to have married her in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And it disqualified him for service, no matter how much he cared for his wife.
Yeah.
No matter how much he wanted that in the first place. So desire and want, and we'll call it genuine love, is not necessarily virtuous in and of itself.
Especially if you're a priest. A Levitical priest. Anything else, guys? I don't want to cut you off. Anything? Observations, Mr. Will? It's good to see you.
Thank you. I think you're very patient.
Yeah. You think it would have been very easy to work for a guy like Nehemiah?
No. It would have been tough.
Why do you think it'd be tough to work for him?
Because a lot of people want to try and get stuff done as quickly as possible without considering long-term consequences.
Yeah. But they did build a wall in 52 days. That's that's pretty good. I think one thing he did well, too, is he listened to his employees. When there were concerns on the floor, remember when they were being threatened? They came up with solutions on how to make sure that they felt as at ease as they could be. And they were concerned for their families. And he understood those kind of things, so I appreciate that. Well, let's close in a word of prayer. We're a little bit late. Sorry about that. Father, we, again, count it a privilege to look into to your word, to see the life of your servant Nehemiah. I pray, Father, that the things that we've learned from him we would cling to, as we cling to your word, because it sustains us, it encourages us, it makes us joyful, Father. Thank you so much for your word and for our time together and our fellowship. We love you, and again commit the rest of this day to you, for it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.